you for coming.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you all for coming here this morning. So I will tell you about the study we've made over several years on this problem of superconductors that are disordered, that undergo a transition to the insulating state. So most of the work has been done by those two fellows, Maoz Ovadia, who's now a postdoc at Harvard, and Benjamin Giuseppe, who was a postdoc in my group, now has his own research laboratory in the University of Chernobyl. And the recent stuff has been and is done by my three very talented graduate students now working in the lab. So we want to talk about the superconductor insulated transition far from equilibrium. I want to introduce a little bit this business of the superconductor insulator itself, and I don't think I really need to do it that deeply here, but I'll briefly describe the essentials. So the easiest way is to use Alan Goldman's group famous experiment, where they have gradually increased the thickness of a bismuth film which has been grown in ultra-high vacuum conditions, measured in low temperature. And you start with the thin film, you have an insulating behavior, and you increase the thickness of the film without breaking the ultra-high vacuum conditions. You still have insulating behavior at low temperature until at some point the system suddenly abruptly changes into superconductor with increasing TC all the way down to the thicker filaments. And then it was convenient to identify this critical thickness as the point where you undergo this transition from insulator to a superconductor. And a lot of you. So this has been a rather interesting and active field on and off. People find interesting things in this disordered superconductor. This is a recent work where they have studied the samples similar to ours, and they saw some Higgs-like excitation. That's one of the things that people have been doing. But overall, I think the focus in this field has been on the physics of the transition. So the transition is sharp. It is usually well-defined. It is a quantum phase transition, presumably. It takes place strictly at t equals zero. It can be driven by thickness, as we've seen, but by many other parameters that sits in a Hamiltonian. And when you change the value, you go across a critical value, the system, the ground state of the system abruptly changes. So we focused on this one of those things here, and that is the magnetic field dependence of this of the superconductor insulator transition. So basically what we do is we take a disordered superconductor that is so highly disordered it is almost insulating on its own, but it is not quite insulating, and then we apply strong magnetic field and see the properties. And this is an example of a set of data that we've measured in one of our indium oxide samples. What you see here is a resistance, again, on a log scale as a function of temperature for different values of the magnetic field starting from zero. When the magnetic field is zero for that particular film, it is so deeply superconductive we cannot measure any signal up to 1 degree. Hence, you just see the noise for zero field. But once you begin to increase the magnetic field value, you see resistances, and you see curves, and you see a critical around 7 Tesla in this case. There's this critical magnetic field value, and then you go into an insulating state. And this is not very different from qualitatively from the experiment of Alan Goldman. group, again, I just want to remind you, this is one film with one thickness where we're changing the strength after a magnetic field. This is not a collection of films like in this case. So the magnetic field driven transition has been studied in late 80s, early 90s, encouraged a lot by the work, I think, of Matthew Fisher. And again, here is a plot of similar experiment like we've done before. It just has plotted slightly differently. This is the resistance now on a linear scale as a function of magnetic field for different temperatures. So basically, both ways of measuring or plotting the data cover the same space, but this is just a different plot. So these are isotherms of magnetic resistance, and they seem to meet at the point. This point is the magnetic field value. This point is where we see this flat curve. There is no temperature dependence, or weak temperature dependence, weaker than the other. And to show that this is a quantum phase transition, indeed, as was suggested by Matthew Fisher, you take this data and you make some changes to, instead of plotting them against the natural parameter, you plot them against some scaling parameter, and all the data seem to collapse. You get an exponent from that. And this type of business has been going on for many years, still goes on now. Every once in a while, you'll see an experiment like that, taking a disordered superconductor, driving it into the insulating state, collapsing all the data, and getting a critical exponent. I don't want to talk about this today. There are better people to ask about this. Actually, there aren't, but. Okay, so we study mostly amorphous indium oxide, and this is typical data that we see. And what is different in this curve from what I've discussed so far is that you have the superconductor here. This is again magnetic field and resistance on a log scale. You have the superconducting region at low field. You have this crossing point where there's no or hardly any temperature dependence in the resistance, and then you have an insulating behavior, but the insulating state here appears to have a maximum. Okay. You go to 12 Tesla, it begins to be weaker. And take a different sample, plot it slightly differently, you can clearly see this insulating peak shape developed. This is a linear scale, so it seems like we're going from zero to zero, but actually we're not. If you plot a log scale, and I'm switching between samples here, so if the numbers don't, from one plot to the next, don't add up, it's because, for convenience, I'm just. So this is one sample. Again, the crossing point, you go from a superconductor at B equals zero, insulating peak, and then this is a sample we took to the magnet lab to 30 Tesla, and you can see that there's clearly a well-defined region where this insulating peak changes into something else. And one can almost identify a field value here where this insulating peak, where there's a strong, very strong magnetic field dependence to the resistance, into a different type of state where there's a much weaker, if any, at all, magnetic field dependence. although this state also seemed to be insulated, right? The resistance is slower, but still increasing as the temperature approaches zero. So this, to us, seems to indicate that there's a transition between one type of insulator here into another type of insulator here. Okay, this is going to be no crossing point here, which we sort of gotten used to when we're looking at transition. Yes.
How did you choose this line? If I look at the curve, it looks like if I go slightly to the left, the plot is going from concave to convex slightly earlier. Like, is this sort of inflection point when we are,
right. So the relative vanishes. So you don't ask this question here, because here there's a crossing point.
Exactly.
So yeah. That's what I was going to say. I was going to say there's no crossing point here, so I have freedom to choose. I'll get back to that in a second.
Right, yes, there is a point at which it becomes concave to convex.
Here.
A bit better earlier.
Yeah. All right. Well,
doesn't matter.
I'll get to that. No, it matters a lot. But not for today's talk, but I'll just mention it briefly, because if you are convinced, as I am, that you have two types of insulators here. Well, this is an insulator, although for that particular sample it's not very clear, but we have other samples where the resistance really goes orders of magnitude here. This is a strongly magnetic field dependent insulator, and this is not. So there has to be some sort of a transition or a crossover between the two types of insulators. There are going to be no crossing point in this transition, even if there was a transition. Why? Because at the t equals zero limit, they're both infinite. So what we have is a transition between an infinite resistance to infinite resistance. But again, if you believe the evolution of the data, the ratio between them is still going to be infinity. Right? It's possible. Because the activation energy is much larger here than here, then at the absolute t equals zero limit, they're both going to be infinity, but one of them is going to still be infinity larger than the other. You'd have an infinitely large step. okay. So we like to call this insulator here the CPI, which is a Cooper pair insulator. And this is a result of, I think, 10 years of work that we and other groups have done to study the properties of this insulator with the tunneling experiment, little parks, measurements, microwave absorption data, and other techniques that pretty much convince us that in this insulator, Cooper pairs are still the relevant charge carriers, even though we have an insulating behavior.
Benny,
yeah.
May I ask, for the sample which is green, what will be temperature dependence of the...
This is all the same sample, right? There's just different temperatures.
What will be temperature dependence at zero magnetic field?
This?
No, for this sample? What will be temperature?
It's a superconductor. This is a
All of them are superconductors.
These are all the same sample, you just measure the different temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all below TC.
But are there other samples which are not superconductors?
Yes, I'll show you in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so to give a bit more flavor why I've chosen this line here, I want to show you this graph is from a paper we recently published, where I'm plotting four different samples. So now the curves are from four different physical samples, okay? And the nice thing about this is that these samples cover the entire range of disorder that we can achieve with our indium oxide, more or less. Okay, so we start with the very cleanest, most low disorder indium oxide sample we can make in our lab. We increase the disorder gradually until we reach a sample which has the highest level of disorder that we're interested in measuring. And in all cases, we just measure the resistance as a function of magnetic field for different temperature. The temperature scale is indicated here. You can see it with the color. If we start with the lowest disorder sample, that J069, you can see that as you increase the magnetic field, it undergoes a transition to basically the normal state. So this is what you expect from any thin film type 2 superconductor. You, at low temperature, you increase the magnetic field. You're going to measure zero resistance. Until at some well-defined value of the magnetic field, you're going to have a transition, which is we call HC2, into the normal state resistance. There's a small hump here, but it is really insignificant. So that's the clean limit. It's very important because it allows us to identify HC2 for our system, for indium disordered indium oxide. If we increase the disorder, we suddenly see two things. One, we see a crossing point separating the superconductor and the insulator. And two, we see the insulator is beginning to get this hump, this peak shape. Increase the disorder further, that's the sample I showed you before. The crossing point, the transition, the superconductor becomes, is pushed to the lower magnetic field values. and we have this very large insulating peak, and it drops down to a different insulator. Now we go to the limit of the highest disorder. That sample is insulating already at B equals zero. So it seems like we still have this peak shape, but the superconductor is already totally gone. Okay? So this covers, this is the entire phase diagram, if you like, for indium oxide with the various level of disorder and magnetic field. And I think what is pretty clear is that HC2, which we can easily identify in the clean limit, is the exact or nearly the same magnetic field value, or at least the same order of magnitude of magnetic field value, that sets the scale for the termination of the insulating peak. Okay, so this is again one of those circumstantial evidence that HC2 is the magnetic field where there are no longer Cooper pairs in the system, and this is exactly where the insulating peak terminates for all, or at least roughly where the insulating peak terminates for all our level of disorder. Okay, so we have this range in magnetic field where we find an insulating behavior, a rather strong insulating behavior that seems to be relying on Cooper pairs in some way or the other for conduction. And again, I haven't shown it to you, just trust me that this is the case. And now you can forget it. It's not going to be important for the rest of, or at least not in a simple way. So now we just have an insulator, a very strong insulator in magnetic field, and we measure its properties. One of the things you can measure is you can measure the current voltage characteristics. So take one of the samples. This is again insulating peak, and fix the magnetic field value at some point and measure the current voltage characteristics. This is the current, that's the voltage, and you can see strongly nonlinear behavior, which is what you expect in an insulator. You need to apply voltage in order for current to flow. That's what an insulator means. I plot it a bit differently, it's the same, but this is now the absolute value of I, so the branch that went there is now. This is a 200 millidegrees.
This looks like zero conductivity.
Well, yeah, on a linear scale, everything would look like
Zero
don't exist for experimentalists.
Okay. By I.
Only in the bank account. Zero is.
Then it can be minus.
Even that can be minus, but never. Zero is an indication of your noise level. So if somebody tells you, "Oh, I measured zero," then you know that. So this is 200 millidegrees, already low temperature. But if you reduce the temperature slightly more to 140 or maybe 40 millidegrees, you can see that there's a qualitative change. The curve is no longer continuous. There's an abrupt drop in the current at some value of the voltage bias.
But is it not symmetric from negative and positive voltage?
No. You can see it here. So this is the positive is the red, and the negative, I just folded them over. The negative is the blue, and there's hysteresis. So you start at a very low bias, you increase the voltage, you follow the black curve, which is ohmic. It doesn't look straight because this is a log scale now, but this is ohmic dependent, and then it deviates slightly from the ohmic dependence, and then it jumps by several orders of magnitude, abruptly. And then it goes into this high branch. And as you lower the voltage on the blue curve, it jumps back, but at usually different. So this is what we find in our low temperature study of the current voltage in this insulator. We published these results in this paper. Then it was discovered in other superconductors undergoing this transition in other disordered superconductors, we use this nice term, collective insulating state. But there were people that used even nicer terms to account for this discontinuous IV characteristics. Again, I don't want to spend much time on this now.
Good question. Can you say something about the functional form of that curve after the jump? Is that sort of ohmic with lower resistance or what?
I can. I will in a minute.
Okay.
So, just to make contact with the latter part of the talk, just about when we were doing these experiments on the current voltage characteristics, Basco, Lehner, and Altshuler were sitting down and doing some calculation on this many-body problem, which I don't need to... I guess, introduced to you at any level. And so this is the paper they came up with. This is some one of the pages in this paper. It's rather complicated for me. Fortunately, a year later, they wrote another paper which is more aimed to the experimentalists. And in this paper, there were graphs. So that's the thing also in the first paper. But interestingly, in the abstract, there is this sentence that they showed that even in the presence of weak coupling to phonons, the transition manifests itself in nonlinear conduction, leading to bistable IV. And they also mentioned that these bistable IV curves can be found in systems that show no signs of superconductivity. And a couple of years later, they addressed our experimental data with the jumps and suggested a simple model to explain the discontinuity in the IV curve that we have been seeing. And this is based on this heat balance approach. And the heat balance to the experimentalist is very simple. You apply external power to the system by your IV measurement. This power goes to the electrons. The electrons want to warm up a little bit, and they have to deliver the power to the phonons, which in turn deliver it to the substrate and to the fridge. And if you maintain a steady state condition, you can solve this problem, this equation numerically. This is a more general form. And now, in order to solve this, you need to apply a few assumptions. And here I'm listing some of them. I think they are rather important for the rest of the talk. The first assumption is that the electron phonon are decoupled. So they're not well coupled. So that allows you, in principle, to have a different temperature between the electrons and the phonons. Second assumption is that the electrons are strongly interacting, so I can define a temperature for the electrons themselves, being different from that of the phonons. A third assumption is my favorite, is that the IV is linear. You see, including the jumps. And the fact, the apparent nonlinearity that we see in our experiment comes from the fact that the electron changed the temperature. So all deviation from linearity come from the fact that the effective electron temperature is changing. Fourth assumption is obvious in the data. The RT is a fast function, some sort of an exponential dependence, which in the insulator is easy to assume. You can use this assumption and a couple of more to write a simplified heat balance equation, which you can solve on the computer. This is an implicit function relating the temperature of the electrons and the temperature of the phonons, and you can solve on the computer, and what you get is you below a certain phonon temperature, there is a bistable region. There are two stable solutions for this equation that the electrons can choose between, depending on. And then in our experiment, again, what you see is you increase the bus voltage. At some point, you begin to warm up the electrons. They can no longer keep up delivering the heat to the phonons because they are weakly coupled. And so they begin to warm up. As they warm up, the resistance is decreasing. There's more current flowing than you expect from this ohmic behavior. They're still ohmic, but they just went into a little bit higher temperature. So the temperature is increasing here until at some point, if you are below this phonon temperature, where you have bistability, the temperature can abruptly change. You go to the high temperature branch, which of course leads to a very large change in the decrease in the resistance and a large increase in the current. Okay? So basically this fancy jumps that you see are just a result of this bistability. So in order to compare this approach to our experimental data, we took a lot of IVs, different phonon temperatures here, and we wanted to convert this this temperature to find out to convert the IVs to represent the fact that the electron changed the temperature. So you need a thermometer for the electrons. Okay, the best way would have been to really measure the electron temperature directly at high bias in order to show this. But this is it turned out to be a rather difficult experiment to do. So we need to do something else. We need to rely on the assumption that really there's no inherent nonlinearity, or it's small, and the change of the resistance only comes from the fact that the temperature of the electron is changing. So you need a thermometer, and in order to use the thermometer, we just use the ohmic measurement of the resistance in equilibrium, or as close to equilibrium as we could make our measurement. So this is the blue curve. This is a resistance, a function of inverse temperature, measured at equilibrium as best as we could. Basically, this limit of V equals zero here. And so you pick a point in your IV curves, say this point here. There's a voltage and a current. You can divide one by the other. You get a resistance. You go into this curve and you find your resistance value here. And you find it on your data, and you find this point on the temperature scale, and that gives you temperature. So the data were measured at 130 millidegrees for this particular curve. But at this point, the resistance have decreased enough that it actually indicates that the electrons are at 200 millidegrees. Okay, this is a very simple process. And you can repeat this for the entire set of data with a computer. And you get a plot. Instead of current, now we're plotting the temperature of the electron versus voltage. And you see the heating at low bias, and you see the jump is really self-consistently just a change in the temperature of the electron, and this appears to be rather reasonable. And you can see in the high bias, you're approaching. You're still not quite at a constant temperature, but you're approaching this. you can also plot the data slightly differently. You plot the temperature of the electron versus temperature of the phonon. This is a bit confusing. We do our experiment at a constant temperature in this case, right? And that means the fridge temperature, but we assume that the phonon temperature are in equilibrium with the fridge temperature. So the fridge temperature is the phonon temperature. And as you increase your bias, you're warming up the electrons. But you do it at a constant, there's no effect on the fridge or the phonon. So that's the assumption. So the phonons remain at a constant temperature. And then you just get those straight lines. It's not very interesting until you reach, you go below a certain phonon temperature. I think it's about 130 millidegrees for that particular sample. And you begin to see that it skips this, the data, this is the jumps that we see, and the excluded region is not very different from what the theorists have predicted. You can take the theory's prediction backwards and generate IVs from them. No. This is the theory. And this is the experiment. And so again, this is the temperature data from another sample, some more recent stuff, because we have been staring at this for several years until we saw that, I think if we listened to our theorist friend more, we would have known it earlier, but we realized that if you remove the labels, and you turn it around, it looks very much like that. Okay, this is our data turned over, and this is the pressure versus the volume sketch for the van der Waals equation for the liquid gas mixture. There's Nobel Prize in some 19, some 12, I forget. So, what does it mean?
Could I just check before you go into this? I mean, how far is this really testing the theory? It seems to me that if the only way you have of knowing the electron temperature is via the value of the resistance, you're not doing a very strong test of the theory. Is that true?
I don't think we have this smoking gun experiment. But there are many cases in condensed matter experiments where you are in a situation like this. And I think overall, take into account, even there are some discrepancies with some numbers also. They cannot really predict the threshold voltage and things like that. But yes, I'm still thinking of a way to directly measure the electron temperature, sure. So what can we learn from this analogy, at least in my simplistic approach? The fact that I can plot my data in a way that look very similar to a liquid gas system that is undergoing this in the coexisting region and undergoing a first order phase transition that ultimately terminates in a second order phase transition. And so I think we can pretty much, I'd love to hear what you guys think about this, but think a little bit about what can we learn from this analogy. So we know that if we do the experiment properly, we can take these differences in the densities between the liquid and the gas and consider this to be our order parameter for the second order phase transition, which takes place here at this critical temperature. And so we can possibly do the same for the difference in the temperature of the electrons and consider that to be our order parameter. And then you can plot the order parameter if you want as a function of the temperature, the phonon temperature. The big difference, by the way, I need to remind you, our experiment is done far away from equilibrium, very far from equilibrium. Okay, I have heat flow constantly being produced from the outside by my measuring circuit. Okay, so one has to begin to think in terms of this out of equilibrium phase transitions. But I think another message that is, to me, seems to be unavoidable from this, but again, maybe I'm wrong, is this business of the critical opalescence. When we come close to second order phase transition, we have this phenomena, which is basically what led people to discover this critical phase transitions. Critical opalescence, what happens is that the liquid and the gas, the density becomes closer to one another. At the same time, there's the difference between the surface tension, the difference between the chemical potential. Is that what causes the surface tension? No? The difference between something and something else.
Surface energy.
Surface energy.
Yeah.
Right. So that is decreasing. And so, because they are no longer different densities, they begin to intermix with each other. Okay. And what we learn from the study of critical phenomena is that for some odd reason, they intermix with each other on every length scale possible, from the microscopic length scale all the way to the length scale of the size of your system, close to the critical point. And if this length scale of intermixture is the relevant length scale for scattering of light, the two transparent fluids now begin to be opaque to the light that we're transmitting. That's why we see this. So what does it mean to us? Perhaps it means that we can not think about... So we cannot think about, maybe we cannot think about our system as being, of the electron system as having just one temperature. Maybe we have to take into account that there could be a mixture of different temperatures in the experiment at the same time, the electron temperature.
I mean, but those Poisson lines, they're unstable, right? You're basically connecting point here and this point there, isn't that right?
Yeah.
Unlike in the left plot where actually every point is stable point.
No, it's not. It's only stable if you do an experiment like that.
Sure.
You change the volume.
Exactly.
If you could change that, that would be exactly the same.
So that's extensive parameter, that's intensive, presumably. So it's very hard to compare.
No, but if you think about the current here, okay, if you just replace, go back and put the current instead of the temperature. Remember, I replaced the temperature of the electron with the current. The current with the temperature of the electron. But let's just think for a moment that I'm replacing back the current here. Okay.
But I mean, still they remain unstable.
So that would mean that there are two different resistances. That there are two different types of electrons. There are electrons that are hotter and electrons that are colder. The electrons that carry the current and electrons that don't carry the current that coexist at the same time in the sample.
So but that's the question. Can you stabilize the system somewhere in between?
In principle, you could. In practice, it's not possible. Because if you have, what? It's not possible here either.
No, but there is a function of volume, you do get coexistence.
Yes, but if you try to do the function of pressure, you cannot.
Sure, but I mean, so...
And we cannot control the current. You cannot drive current through an insulator. Because in order to drive current through an insulator, the current source has to be an ideal current source, meaning that it has to have an infinite output impedance. And if your sample resistance is so large, it's not possible. You cannot stabilize the current. I tried that. You cannot stabilize the current through an insulator. You have to drive it with voltage. Just not possible. It's exactly like a superconductor. You cannot stabilize voltage on a superconductor. No machine exists. I cannot buy or make an amplifier, a current source that is going to be able to stabilize this current here. But I don't think it's very different from this. So I don't have this... this knob that...
But yeah, it's different.
What it means again is open, totally open. To me it seems that you have an inhomogeneous system and you apply a large voltage, you're going to have breakdown in specified locations in the sample. It's not going to be uniform. And you're going to generate the heat at these points in the sample, not all over the sample. It's possible that some of the electrons have transitioned to the higher temperature, while the others have not. But that's just there's no theory behind it. It's just words and this you can ignore it. time dependence.
One question, sorry, before you, about the same thing. Is there some, so in the critical operations, there is a diverging length scale, and the, in this case, do you have such thing? If there is, then can you measure it? Do you know what is it? Is there some notion of length scale which is?
Yeah, but I don't know of what.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there are critical exponents that you can, in principle, measure. Sure. We have, but we measure them. We didn't measure them properly.
But there is some expectation that there is some.
I don't know what to expect from non-equilibrium fission. I don't know much about that.
So it could be some percolating cluster of more conductive regions,
right,
which begins to span this.
Right. But then this again is still an equilibrium picture, and this is a non-equilibrium. So one has to look for this directed percolation theories, which.
So in principle, can you imagine having lots of contacts on the sample and being able to see different current paths develop and so on?
Yeah. It's one of the experiments we are thinking of doing is trying to locally detect where the current is flowing in.
And can you measure temperature locally as well?
Did the movie already go? No. What? Sorry.
Can you measure temperature also locally? Can you put some thermocouples or, I don't know.
But that would measure the phonon temperature. To measure the electron temperature, again, unfortunately, the best way is noise. But it's not possible for us to measure noise at those high resistance samples. It's very. But we're still working on ways to. Where is my movie? It's not working. Okay, no popcorn.
Yes, it's going.
What? Ah, it is going. All right, so you just have a little bit of popcorn left. What? All right, let's forget about the movie. So let me just briefly tell you what we see in this experiment. This is now measurement of the current in one of our sample in the insulating state at low temperature as a function of time. To 2,500 seconds. And you start at the zero voltage. You see the red. This is the voltage scale here, which is the red steps are indicating what the voltage is. Okay, so at zero voltage, there's a little bit of noise, but there is no DC current flowing. Then you increase the voltage to maybe half a millivolt, and there's still no current flowing. Every time we switch, there's a little bit of noise, transient noise, but that is expected from the electronics. You see it here again. 2 millivolts, you begin to see DC current. It's bigger than that. So there's some DC current beginning to flow, but still the noise level is relatively small. 2.2, 2.3, you begin to see this huge current fluctuation. So now if you, in the movie, you'd see that this is just goes up and down. So I'm applying voltage close to the threshold voltage, not quite beyond. So the system is so sensitive, I think, that it begins to wander between the different possible states. And you see that you don't only have two distinct, like in the DC experiments, you have two distinct values of the current. Here, we seem to be able to sample values in the middle also. Okay, so I have a few more minutes left to tell you the interesting stuff. I think I ran out of time. No? Okay. Ah, yes, you're right, right. Sorry. Oh, I have a lot of time. Okay. So now we've convinced ourselves that we have an insulator where we have this bistable electron temperature according to our understanding. And this gave us the motivation to look for this, to ask the question, what is the ohmic transport in that system, believe it or not. So basically, we did study the ohmic dependence, but only up to some relatively convenient value of the resistance. But everything together, this the fact, and that's why I'm also presenting this in this historical, in the order that we've done the experiments, because the fact that we see these jumps in the current voltage characteristics may be indicating that the electron phonons are decoupled, and that's why it gives the motivation to look at the ohmic transport and see what's what. So again, early experiment, we were limited to about a gigaohm in our resistance value, but we spent a lot of time and effort in being able to get here the 1 to 3.5 more orders of magnitude in the resistance. This has been done by several different improvements to our system. Some of which, one of them is that instead of sweeping the magnetic field, we fix the magnetic field, we fix the temperature, we wait for a while, we measure the current voltage characteristics at each point, and we do our best to identify an ohmic regime. If not, we try to extrapolate to V equals zero and get the value, the actual value of the resistance in the system. So indications to what I'll show you were seen a bit earlier, but this is basically the result of our, this is the bulk of the data that we have from our, you see each one of those points is this fixing everything and measuring IV, and this covers the magnetic field range from half a Tesla all the way to 12. So now the colors are not the temperature, this is the resistance, this is inverse temperature, and the color are the value of the magnetic field. 12 is the highest, 0.5 is the lowest. And what is obvious is that none of those curves here is Arrhenius. Okay, Arrhenius is a straight line. None of those curves is a straight line. Of course, over a limited range, yes, you can fit a straight line to any of them. But looking at the data like that, none of them is a straight line. And there are two types of deviation. We start with the low field. The low field is actually much faster than what you get from Arrhenius. It has a concave shape. High field, 12 Tesla data, for example, is slower. So since we are more comfortable with that, I'll start with that. So this is, again, a sketch on the linear scale of our insulating peak. It's just a map to show you where we are. And if we measure in this regime at the high field beyond the peak, or where the peak is decaying, we get traces like that. So you measure the resistance as a function of temperature, and you plot it theta to 1/2, you get a straight line more or less. And this is something we're familiar with. This is the Foslowski type hopping. But if you go to the low field, you get something very different. See, this is measured here at 0.75 Tesla. And it's more convenient to try to convey to you what we are seeing here if we plot it, the conductivity versus temperature. Not the resistivity versus inverse, but the conductivity versus temperature. It's the same data, and you can see it looks like that. If I try to fit activation behavior to this, obviously, totally misses the data. But this form seemed to work well. This is a form that we sort of, I think we guessed it somehow. We tried some other things, but nothing worked so well as this activation to some temperature, finite temperature. So again, we can disagree on the form, but what I think is quite clear and I think is quite outstanding in this data is that if you plot it, for instance, next to the Foslowski type of your ordinary insulator, you can see that up to maybe even 50 millidegrees, there's a large 3 or 4 orders of magnitude disparity between them, and it's all been caught within a very narrow range of temperature. You see, this is just chasing it down and almost overtaking the high field resistance. So if you're used to measuring dilution refrigerators, they all have dilution refrigerators, right? Then you know that usually below 100 or if you're lucky below 50 millidegrees, there's hardly any change in most of the measurements you do. And it's true for our fridge as well. But for some reason, in this case, there's a huge drop of the conductance here, or a huge increase in the resistance in this range where usually it's basically dead. Right. So I'm nearly at the point of the end. This is a linear plot of the same data of the conductivity versus the temperature. This is the sketch, right? Sketch. And this is the superconductivity transition in one of our samples measured at B equals zero. Okay, this is resistance. And you can see that if anything, this is sharper than that. So let me just finish with three points. Okay? So I'll go back to... this if you... So there are three possibilities, I think. One is that we're doing something wrong in our experiment to obtain data like that. That's certainly a possibility, although everything we could think of would give you the error the other way. Right. It's not going to speed up the increase of the resistance. Everything you do will actually have the opposite. But still, it's possible that keep this in mind. It's still possible. But if it's not, then there are still two possibilities. One is that there's going to be some explanation for this, which is trivial, some inhomogeneity, some domains. I don't really know. I haven't found one that gives us this. The third possibility is there's really something interesting here, that the conductance really does seem to drop to zero at a finite temperature, and there are I think it's open for discussion. What can for instance, you can imagine that for some reason the phonons are not there up to 35 millidegrees. But I don't know. Is it possible?
Phonons are never there. Nothing here is determined by phonons. Trust me.
No. But still, I'm toying with other imaginary. Because it looks like the fact that I warm up the system. Imagine I would start at zero. I warm it up to 35 millidegrees. Nothing happens. So it's either the system is really, or the phonons are not there for some reason, or they're localized. It's possible. Not possible that they're localized, right? You prove that?
No, phonons are not localized. Phonons right. Cannot be localized because you have substrate. But electron-phonon coupling is so weak at this temperature that I don't believe that it's
relevant
has anything
at all
to do with anything.
So why is it? Why is it so strongly temperature dependent?
Well, because phonons at low temperatures, first of all, they have huge wavelengths, and second, coupling is weak, especially if you don't have a system like gallium arsenide where there are piezo phonons. Deformation phonons are having very weak coupling, like in systems like silicon, and I don't know what about indium oxide, but I don't see any reason why it would be stronger coupling. So in any case, in front of Efrosh-Plovsky, there should be huge power of the temperature divided by the divide temperature, which is, the ratio is 10 to the minus 4 to some power. I mean, what we're speaking about.
Yeah, but he still didn't answer, right? He did? Why do we have this big...
If you want my explanation, and I can give it to you either privately or now, but it has nothing to do with phonons.
Okay.
How much are sample-to-sample fluctuations of this curve?
I'm sorry?
If I have different samples, how much does it vary, this curve? It's always the same T star.
We get basically the same. We have not have a complete map of different samples with different T-star. We have measured it at different fields for that particular sample. But overall, it doesn't look.
Do you have many samples which show this? Isn't there a unique sample?
Yes, no. Almost all the samples, as long as the disorder is large. I think when in the clean limit you don't see any. You need to have this big insulating state.
And what are the values of sigma naught in these bits?
I forgot. I have. I forgot.
So, what are the dimensions of your samples, and like, are they truly macroscopic in a sense there can be some length scale of equilibration between, let's say, phonon system and electron system?
So these are all relatively large, half a millimeter to a tenth of a millimeter. If you make the sample small, you don't see any of that. Nothing. If you make them one dimensional, you don't see any of that. Well, approximately one dimension. Contrary to my intuition, if I make the sample one-dimensional, the insulating behavior is gone. So you'd expect it to be more insulating, but it's...
If you take the sample which is more disordered, not like this, which requires only a very weak magnetic field to become insulating. So suppose you take a little more disordered sample. So what happens to this
picture? So this is actually very difficult experiment and time consuming. So we haven't looked, but what I can tell you now is that even samples that are disordered that have a B equals zero insulator, this is what you were asking, they still show the discontinuous IVs. So that's a good point to start, but we have not studied this yet.
What is the estimate for T0?
T0, I think, was about a couple of hundred millidegrees.
In cadence.
0.2.
Just to understand, when you reach this shell at temperatures which are considerably greater than T0. According to this expression, when temperature is much greater than T0, the exponent dies.
Yes? Yeah.
Then the question is, this means that sigma sub zero, the price, doesn't depend on temperature drastically at such temperatures, high temperatures.
We assumed here that it's not, but maybe we could...
But I'm looking at your plot, and
yes.
I see that your sigma becomes almost constant
here.
At large temperatures. Yes,
here.
And that's why my question, what about T0? Can it be associated with this shelf or not?
Shelf. Yeah, I think T0 is pretty much here.
But maybe you have some independent estimate for T0. What is your temperature T sub zero? What is your estimate for T0?
0.2, 200 mK, what do you know? 0.2,
approximately. Also varies from value.
But this means that quantity, the pre-exponent is almost constant. It doesn't depend on this.
Yeah, this is, you see, the dashed line assumes that it is constant.
Well, there are three constants here, sigma okay. 0, T star, and T naught.
Right.
They are all constants.
Okay.
It's three parameters for one curve, I think. It's more than enough.
uh,
question. So you mentioned that in this regime you expect that there to be Cooper pairs still rather than individual electrons, right? So, but after that you didn't mention it anymore. So what? Why would this happen only with Cooper pairs?
I don't know if it happens only with Cooper pairs. I don't think that people have looked. But I have a guess, but it's probably wrong.
What's the guess?
Later.
Okay.
I'll embarrass myself just in front of you. No, if you have, at least from the experimentalist, simplistic point of view, the superconductor it does not interact with phonons. I know it's weird, but the superconducting condensate don't interact with phonons. If it did, it would give you resistance. And it doesn't conduct heat at all. As a matter of fact, in my laboratory, I have switches. You turn off the superconductivity, it conducts heat. You turn the superconductivity on, it's a heat insulator. So maybe there's something related to that. If you have superconductivity somehow locally in this insulator, that could be a limiting factor for the phonon. But maybe it's...
Going back to measuring this temperature, in this effective temperature of electrons versus phonons, is getting thermopower a good idea? Thermopower, is it at a... Is that something... Because it's sort of... It's related to transport, but it's... Still, maybe the effective entropy in some level, but is the effective degree of freedom in the system, but it's being transport really?
Yeah, we have a setup now where we're trying to do that, but you're always in the insulating regime, it's always a mess. Everything, any one of those techniques that needs to be, you need to measure voltage. Mm-hmm. You cannot measure voltage in this. Not possible to measure voltage in these. You can only drive. You cannot do any four-terminal configuration.
The magnetic field is out of plane.
Yes.
So,
it's a good question because we have also data with the parallel field.
What's the difference?
A parallel is like that and perpendicular is
like that. What's the difference in your data?
No, we don't have this high value of resistances. But we have a lot, but we will. Yes.
So two questions. First of all, if you change the magnetic field and replot these curves, there is a point where the T star goes to zero, or how does it?
It's difficult. It's really difficult to get those parameters. So it seems to be increasing at the beginning, but then we can't measure it anymore. We have okay.
Because you fall out of equilibrium?
No, because the curves become more complicated than just. So the curves have this, they begin like that and they end up like that.
Oh, I see.
So I don't know. This is.
So
this
is it possible that you're seeing also. Well, probably you are seeing a crossover. It's just the question. So if it's a function like this and go.
As a function of temperature.
As a function of temperature to the variable range hopping.
But then I
plot the transition, the crossover temperature as a function of.
So you want me to do what everybody else is doing? You want me to limit my range and fit one behavior here and one behavior there? I rather not.
I'm just asking whether really there is some crossover. Maybe the crossover temperature eventually diverges, but I'm just.
But once I limit my range here, I cannot make a real statement, you know. It's at least not as good as I can make in the extremes. So but it's worthwhile.
But you don't show here the level of noise at the highest resistance. It's all just triangles. But is it huge? Is it? But you have this triangle. What was the level of noise? Is it really a small point or you don't?
It's not small. This point is about 10 to the 12 ohms.
That's what I'm asking. When you measure it,
it's a log
10
scale.
To the 12 ohm. Is it noisy?
No. Well, when it's noisy, I cannot measure no. But remember, this is, you measure IV curve. The IV are noisy. But then you fit some function through it, and then you get rid of most of the noise.
Is it really let's look at the curve which is at the smallest magnetic field, 0.5.
Yes.
Is there some reentrance in the beginning?
Yes, there is a little.
It goes first down and then up.
That's simple. Here, yes.
In terms of your parameters, T star, T zero, is what is the dependence on the magnetic field?
I think I have. It's after the thank you. This is a T star, and this is T zero. This is the magnetic field. And this is BC. So unfortunately, in this sample, we don't have pinpoint BC, but it's somewhere here.
Danny,
Boris,
since you start to speak about the noise, what kind of noise you have in ID? Is it 1/F? Is it Nyquist? What?
No, we haven't. No, we haven't.
But is it possible to do?
I don't know. It's again. This is. I will be only able to measure the current noise.
Yeah, current noise. But can you analyze it in a Fourier?
Yeah, I think we could.
Because
we haven't done that.
The interesting question is if if there is fluctuation dissipation theorem violation.
Right.
What about long depth factor for this material? What about the long depth factor, effective long depth factor for this material?
What is it?
Effective magnetic moment of electron. You don't know. You see, the T0 is approximate of the value of magnetic moment. Zeeman energy. Can it be some magnetic reason or something like that?
Yeah. Could be.
Did we look at AC conductivity?
High frequency?
AC conductivity.
Microwave? High frequency? Not in this regime. Not in the low temperature.
Up to 1 degree.
Okay. Thank you for your attention.